What's up, everybody? It's Austin Rivers from Off Guard, and I've got some exciting news. Off Guard, hosted by me and my guy Pasha Hagigi, is officially moving to our own podcast feed. We are now dropping two shows every week. Me and Pasha go way back and talk so much hoops already that we figured it was time to fire up the mics and let you in on these conversations. Every week, Pasha and myself will hit on the biggest stories happening around the league. Tap into the show twice a week on our new Off Guard feed on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Off the Pike, presented by FanDuel. April showers bring a loaded sports calendar, and FanDuel is the place to bet on it all. Right now, you can check out the new and improved Parlay Hub. Filter by odds, sport, and bet type to easily find the most popular parlays and same-game parlays all on one page. Plus, start betting on the Explore page and the Pulse and get paid instantly when you win. So download the app today and bet with FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook. The Ringer is committed to responsible gaming. Please visit rg-help.com to learn more about the resources and helplines available and listen to the end of this episode for additional details. Must be 21 plus and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit rg-help.com.
There's no better feeling than a personal win, and the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
Welcome into Off the Pike. I'm Brian Barrett. A great Sunday here locally as the Bruins, of course, take a 1-0 series lead on the Maple Leafs in dominant fashion on Saturday night in the Garden. A lot of leafy things in this game, right? A lot of things that we've seen Toronto do in the postseason before. So we'll get into that in a little bit. And of course, the Celtics with a huge game one win over Miami. They were dominant for the most part of this game. And it's always nice to beat Miami because this is the reality of the situation. They are the biggest rival to the Celtics in the Eastern Conference, even if they're not at full force. They're not the biggest threat to the Celtics this year, but it is always nice to beat your rival, right? So let's get to the Celts first. That game got a little bit too close. I think we can all acknowledge that in that fourth quarter. I was actually wondering to myself watching the game, should Mazzulla be pulling guys here at the start of the fourth? Because the Celtics are up by like 30 points at that particular point. And then DeLon Wright just goes nuts. This guy has an out-of-body experience where he hits five threes. This is a player that hit 25 threes the whole season. He hit five of them in a row in the fourth quarter after hitting 25 all season. And I'm thinking to myself, oh, this is Heat magic again. This team, they always come up with something, right? Like something weird always happens when you play Miami. You think back to last year and you're thinking, wait, is this the Caleb Martin thing? And look, not that I ever thought the Celtics were going to blow this lead that they had in the fourth quarter, but I'm just thinking about for the remainder of the series where Caleb Martin last year basically turned into prime Ray Allen, where he shoots 48.9% from deep in that series. He arguably was the MVP of the Eastern Conference Finals, even though it went to Jimmy Butler. He went nuts in that game 70 at 26 points. So I'm thinking to myself, wait, DeLon Wright all of a sudden is going to be a good three-point shooter? Guy's never been a good three-point shooter in his career. Neither had Caleb Martin. Remember, Caleb Martin in his career is a guy that's south of 36% from deep. It's a guy today, 0 of 4 from the floor. He had 4 points, or 0 of 4 from deep, I should say. He had 4 points, and he missed back-to-back threes. And at one point, Tatum was like waving to him, go ahead and take it, because he's not a good three-point shooter. Yet against the Celtics last year, he somehow was. And DeLon Wright, same thing. This guy's been below 36% from deep in his career. You figured, okay, now all of a sudden he's going to be the guy that is doing it. So I was just having flashbacks to that. And as I mentioned, not that I was threatened in this game or anything along those lines, but it was crazy seeing another random guy on the Heat hit a bunch of threes like we experienced last year in the Eastern Conference Finals. The good thing about this one, the Celtics won this thing in convincing fashion. Oh, by the way, on Caleb Martin, at the end of the game there, 1 minute left, he runs into Jason Tatum when Tatum was easily going to get that rebound. And I know on the broadcast, Doris Burke and J.J. Redick, they didn't think that was a dirty play. I did. Jason Tatum jumped straight up for a rebound, and he just ran into him. He wasn't even going for the rebound. He just ran into Jason Tatum. So I did think that was dirty. I love the way that Tatum just flew up off the ground. And then you had Jaylen Brown getting into it with Caleb Martin, which I love. Sort of sending the message, hey, we're not going to do what we did last year. You're not going to punk us. You're not going to punk us like you did last year. We're not going to let you punk us like the Warriors did 2 years ago. That stuff's not happening. You touch our best player, we're going to get up and we're going to get in your face. So I did love that from Jaylen Brown. Although I will say this, if the Celtics played better in that fourth quarter, maybe you wouldn't be in that situation where your best player, and clearly the best player in the series, could have possibly been injured with a minute left in the game. So that's the one thing, if you want to sort of get upset about this particular game, that would be the one thing you could say is, you know what, guys, probably be a little bit better there in the fourth quarter. Then you don't have to have your starters out there as late as you did. Quite frankly, I thought that they could have pulled them earlier, but nonetheless, the Celtics had those guys out. There's something that Joe does a lot. He keeps guys in late, but nonetheless, that was something at the end of the game there where the Heat just, DeLon Wright starts going nuts. But anyway, I will say this as it pertains to that fourth quarter. I don't think the Heat in any way, shape, or form are going to have a carryover effect. Like, okay, they played decent in the fourth quarter, but it wasn't like Hero got going, right? Hero in that game was 4 of 13. He had 11 points. It was just DeLon Wright hitting a bunch of threes. Now, if DeLon Wright in game two hits a bunch of threes, I'll say, yeah, they found something that carried over. I'll admit that I'm wrong, but I don't think they found anything in particular in that quarter where it's like, oh, this is how they were beating the Celtics. Nothing. So it's not one of these things where you say, hey, it's a long series. They found something they could go to as the series goes on. I don't buy that whatsoever. I do love the way that the Celtics started this game. They really had not played a game, a real true game, if we think about this, right, that meant something that they went all out in since, what, the end of March? And what was the reaction? It was like they were shot out of a cannon to begin the game. You could tell they were just waiting for this. They were just waiting for this moment to come where they could actually lace them up for real again because they had such a big lead in that Eastern Conference at the end of the season. And they were awesome in the third, too. They come out of the locker room, outscore Miami 31-14. And you know what jumped out to me? The same thing that jumped out to me the first game of the regular season when the Celtics played the Knicks, and the first game they played the Miami Heat this year. It's just different when they have Kristaps Porzingis. It is a totally different matchup than it's been at any point during this rivalry in terms of the recent guys. I'm not going back to Pierce against LeBron and Wade. I'm going back to the recent guys. With these core group of players, biggest difference now is the Celtics have Porzingis. And I know they don't have Jimmy Butler on the other side, but this team has screwed up the Celtics offense on multiple occasions in the playoffs, right? Where at times they would just switch everything 1 through 5 because they were so comfortable having Bam switch on to a guard, having Bam switch on to Jaylen Brown or Jason Tatum. They could switch everything. That screwed them up at times. The other thing that has screwed the Celtics up at times is when Miami goes to that zone. And what we saw in this game, Spoelstra tried to muck it up. He went to the zone for long stretches, and man, did the Celtics destroy that thing. When in previous years, we have seen issues against the zone. Or they would, what we've seen at times too, they force the Celtics into iso ball. That's why they do all that switching. They force you into an isolation team. They couldn't do any of those things. They could play the zone. It just didn't work. And they can't switch everything now because of the presence of Porzingis. So one of the things that sticks out to me is if you look at that, really the first quarter and into the first half, Miami's playing a lot of zone. So in that first half, Porzingis finishes with 18. He hits 4 threes. Okay. Or I should say, yeah, he hit 4 threes. So at one point, they have his own. Porzingis gets the ball at the free throw line. Tyler Hero is the nearest defender on him in the zone. Porzingis is like, hey, really? I'm just going to shoot the ball right over him? Like, he can't affect my shot. Makes it 7-0. Again, same type of play. Porzingis at the free throw line. Tyler Hero on him. Boom, it's like pop a shot. I'm just going to shoot this ball right over you. Makes it 14. Or at that point, it was 14-0, I believe. Then he hits a three ball, 23-10. It's another three ball, 55-38. Another three ball, 58-41. So he finishes that first half with the 13 points, finishes the game, I should say, total of 18. But one of the things that sticks out to you is they just don't have an answer for how to guard Porzingis. If you're going to play a zone, he can just go right into the free throw line area and hit a jumper over smaller defenders. And he can also be engaged as a spacer where you have to chase him out to 27 feet because he's going to be able to hit a three. So there's really not a good choice right now to guard the Celtics team with how the Miami team is currently constructed. So Porzingis has now solved two problems for the Celtics offensively. You can't zone and you can't switch. These are two things the Heat have lived on in the past against the Celtics. And at certain points, it was the zone. At certain points, it was the switching schemes. Now they just really don't have an answer because what is Bam going to do? If you are playing man and you have Bam on Porzingis, the Celtics can basically say, oh shit, their best defender is now on Porzingis. The guy that can help on everything is on Porzingis. Kristaps, just go spot up. Just spot up in the wing extended area. What's Bam going to do? Is Bam going to help off that? Because now Porzingis is getting open threes. And if he doesn't help, then you have all these one-on-one matchups that the Celtics can just exploit. So Porzingis has just opened up so much for this team throughout the season, but in this matchup in particular, and it's not a coincidence that the Celtics made this move and we're seeing it work against the team that has given them so much trouble. This is the team, and look, they did it for other teams as well, but this is the team where they saw this problem in the past, offensively in the postseason, so they made this move and we totally saw it. And then the other thing I would say is this, against this zone, the Celtics now, they just have way too much shooting. If you're going to zone them up, you're in massive trouble because you look, think about it today. Okay, they bring Hauser onto the court, comes in, bang, they get a wide open three after some ball movement, makes it 29-23. He hits another open three against the zone, 32-25. Another wide open three against the zone, 35-25 on the next possession. Then, Jason Tatum with an unbelievable find to Hauser where Tatum catches the ball. Drew comes off like he's going to get a handoff. Drew doesn't get it. Tatum is backing down his defender. Al Horford is in the wing. So what Al does is he cuts. Tatum knows what Al is doing. Al is going to bring a defender with him from the zone. So when Al cuts, Hauser moves over just a little bit. Tatum waits for Al to cut. And then he throws a bullet over to Hauser, sets him up for another open three. So they know exactly where the spots are going to be open in the zone. And they just have to knock down the shots. And they've been the best shooting team in the NBA all season long. You go out there. He goes on the court, does Hauser for that stint that he was out there. 8 minutes, he hit four threes. 12 points. I mean, those are the answers this team now has to the zone, whether it's Porzingis and whether it's the shooting. Because if you move the ball against the zone, you're eventually going to either find a good three-point shot or a layup. In the case today, it was easy opportunities from deep. So if you look at the Celtics in this game, they hit 49, or they take 49 threes. That would be awesome if they hit 49. Imagine that. But they got up 49 threes, and they averaged 42 and a half attempts from deep on the season. So they were 6.5 more than they usually get. And the Celtics take the most threes in the NBA. This isn't a secret. So they got exactly what they wanted in this game. Everything they wanted to get offensively, the Heat did nothing. There was no resistance from the Heat to prevent the Celtics from getting the shots that they wanted. They didn't take anything away. They tried different things. None of them worked. The Celtics had 22 threes. They averaged 16 and a half per game this past season, the most in the league. So they hit, what, 4.5 more than they ordinarily do. So basically, this is easier than a lot of regular season games for the Celtics because they just have so many advantages against this Heat team, especially with Butler not in the lineup. So, and by the way, you look at the numbers on that. What's that? 44.9%, a shade under 45%. They hit 38.8% during the regular season, which was second best to OKC at 38.9%. So basically, they were number one in the league, missed out by decimal points. And remember, the Celtics take way more threes than OKC. So they didn't just get up the threes they wanted. They hit the threes they wanted at a higher rate than they ordinarily do. So this team just does not have answers right now for what the Celtics do. Now, Spoelstra's got time to try to come up with something. I just don't think he has the personnel to be able to put together a competent defense against the Celtics teams. The Celtics got all the shots they wanted. The only thing you could really criticize is, look, they didn't shoot the ball well in the restricted area, but that was basically just Jaylen. Jaylen did not have a good finishing game. He was 1 of 5 inside the restricted area. So the numbers for the team are 6 of 14, but the rest of the team is 5 of 9. It's really Jaylen just didn't finish a couple of shots that he ordinarily does. So that's, if you're going to critique something, that'd basically be it about the offense. And it's not really even a critique. Those are shots that Jaylen ordinarily hits. So, and if you think about it too, so Tatum's the only, and Tatum didn't even hit threes, right? Tatum was 1 of 8. He had his first career playoff triple-double, and he was 1 of 8 from deep. I mean, not that that would have prevented him from getting to the 10-point threshold, but you get my point here, is all these other guys, except Tatum, that played because the Celtics cut the rotation. This is another interesting thing. And I know Cornette was unavailable, but they cut the rotation to 8 guys for this game, right? They only played Al, Hauser, and Pritchard off the bench. And basically, when you look at it, everybody in the starting lineup, outside of Tatum, hit at least 2 threes. So you look at these numbers on the season, if you just take catch-and-shoot threes, because that's what the Celtics get against the zone. Not a lot of pull-ups with the exception of Jason Tatum. But if you look at catch-and-shoot threes this season, Drew's at 45.7, Tatum's at 43, Al's at 42.9, Hauser's at 42.5, White's at 41.9, Pritchard's at 41.8, Porzingis is at 38.8%. You're going to get good shots against the zone because you have great shooters. So You can generate shots if you can't knock them down. Obviously, this is Captain Obvious. It's not going to be effective for you. The Celtics do. They have so many different guys that are reliable shooters, right? So if they're going to play that zone, the Heat are going to get crushed. We'll see what they do moving on in this series. But the other thing I would say is if they go away from the zone, it's just they don't really have good matchups for these Celtics guys defensively. They really don't. So Miami, they don't have a good answer for what the Celtics do, because especially considering they have no Butler, who is probably their second best defensive player behind what Bam Adebayo does. Even at Butler's age, he's still a really good defensive player. But again, really, how many good defenders do they have in that starting lineup? Bam, that's it. They have a bunch of guys that you could attack. So it's like you understand why Spoelstra is playing a zone, because he doesn't feel like one-on-one or in man, they can handle these guys. The one thing they did have, I would say a tiny bit of success, is when they put that token pressure on, where it's a press, but it's not really a press. It's not like a classic Rick Pitino press, right? Going, I know that's not a great comparison for Celtics fans, but if you watch Rick Pitino's teams play at the collegiate level, they want to press you, they want to turn you over. What Miami's trying to do is just eat up some of the shot clock and try to get you out of your offense. That's the one thing that maybe they had a little bit of success with, but that's not something that's going to be sustainable throughout this series. Now, I will say this. We alluded to Marcus not being here with Porzingis here. Like, that's why you have Porzingis over Marcus. And then you have Drew here too, right? So you actually got an upgrade at Marcus's position along with Porzingis. And we saw what Drew did in this game. We've talked about this throughout the season. They've used Drew in so many different ways this year, whether it's as a roamer, whether it's on a big, right? He'll cover the Embiids, he'll cover the Giannis's. Or what they did in this game is they just said, you know what, Drew, just take out Hero. Hero was 4 of 13 in this game, 3 of 9 from deep. The guy can't dribble. He's not a good, it's crazy to think about this from a guard's perspective, a guy that actually handles the ball a decent amount. Like, he can take a couple of pull-up jumpers and whatnot, but he's not a great creator for other people. Just if he has the ball in his hands, he's not a great player that way. He's better like coming off screens and stuff along those lines. And Drew just ate him up. So you have that matchup to go to all series long as well. Let's get to Tatum. Usually, I don't make much of the mic'd up stuff during these games, but I did love Tatum before the game, where he's talking to Derek White saying, this is what we've been waiting for all summer, all preseason, the regular season, the All-Star break. He even mentioned the in-season tournament. And right there and then, I thought to myself, like, okay, I actually like this. He is completely dialed in. This team and the best player, they are ready for the moment. This is their chance. They know how they're going to be judged. This is the only team in the NBA. I guess there's other teams you could point to, but this is the team that's going to be judged the most harshly by what they do in the postseason. They know it. There's nothing they've been able to do about it for the past 11 months. Just try to get better each and every day, have the best regular season you possibly could, win the Eastern Conference, have one of the best net ratings that you've ever had or that we've ever seen, quite frankly, in the history of the NBA, a top four net rating of all time. So do all that, and then you'll get your chance, right? Even all that stuff, it doesn't mean anything until you get to the postseason. And we saw what the Celtics are able to do today, and in particular, Jason Tatum. They are fired up for the moment. So I did think that was sort of interesting when Tatum said that. I'm like, yeah, they kind of feel the same way the fans do, where we enjoy the regular season, but Tatum knows, like we know in the fan base, you got to do it in the you got to get over the hump, right? And Tatum has that same, I don't want to say anxiety, but Tatum has that same fire to prove everybody wrong and get himself over the hump. You look at Tatum, he goes for 23, 10, and 10. He also got to the line 8 times. I know some of those were at the end there. But just looking at the first half, I mentioned like setting the tone, hearing him on that mic'd up stuff. Right away, drives by Hawkes, makes it 9-0. Hits a 3-ball, makes it 17-2. He gets Hero on him right away, spins away from mismatch 37-25, taking advantage of those. I mentioned the great pass he had to Hauser. But he had a fadeaway over Highsmith at the free throw area. And then he did draw a BS foul on Highsmith where he jumped into him. That shouldn't have been a foul, but hey, he got two free throws out of it. Then he went right out over Hawkes on another jumper. And then he had that great steal on Hero, goes coast to coast to make it 52-36. So if you look at that first half, 15 points, 8 boards, 6 assists, your best player came out incredibly fired up, incredibly motivated. And he's the guy that has to lead this team. He hears the discourse. He took it onto the court. He was tremendous in this one. I thought it was a good Derek White game. He barely shot the ball in the first half, and then he finishes with 20 points. And he had, 16 of those in the second half. And really what he did is he just sat back in the first half, and it was like, oh, it's going to be Porzingis. It's going to be Tatum. I'm fine. Let them make their shots, and I'll pick my spots when I need to. And what do you know? It's another typical Derek White game where we mentioned the points, but he finishes plus 24, which was by far the best in the game, 5 points better than anybody else. Pritchard was second, if you're wondering. So he had the best plus minus, and he basically, from a statistical perspective, didn't do much in the first half. He sat back and he made the right basketball plays. One thing did stick out to me, though. 23-12, Tyler Hero's in transition. Derek White, the same block we've seen all season long, chases the guy down, gets in front of Hero, blocks him. That was awesome. But then in the second half, I talk about him taking over. Pull-up jumper over Tyler Hero, 60-43. Three ball, 71-54. Drives, pull-up, gets fouled, hits both free throws, makes it 82-57. Then he had a head fake, goes into an elbow jumper, hits that. Then he had the three right off the tip, which was like a quick trigger. Jalen won that tip. And then the top of the key three to make it 99-68. And then he hit that wing three to make it 106-88. When the Heat were creeping there a little bit and he made the correct play and hit the three that needed. That's what I mean. He's one of these guys that just, I feel at ease when he has the ball. A lot of other guys, and especially in the past, you feel nervous when they have the ball. Whenever Derek White has the ball in the fourth quarter, I'm at ease because his numbers all season have been outstanding, but you just feel he's going to make the right play and he continues to do it. I would say it wasn't an unbelievable Jalen game, but he was fine. And not that I had any real issues with his game. He had the 8 rebounds to go along with his 17 points, but you know what I'm talking about. Like, the great Jalen games are the one where he just comes off the screen. We've seen it so many times in the past, but I thought he did his job. He was fine in this game. And I did think that he really did display at times his overwhelming athleticism, and that is going to give the Heat trouble throughout this series, where he went right around Hawkes to the basket. He had a corner three, but then he blocked Hero in the second half. It was 66-47. He had a block on a Hero three. It's not often that you see a swingman blocking another or a guard or a swingman's three. That just doesn't happen a lot. We'll see it occasionally from bigs. It's a rarity to begin with, but blocking a guard's three and you being a swingman and Jaylen Brown, that's pretty impressive. And then he had that Euro in transition that I thought was outstanding, 86-57. So I would expect an even bigger game too from Jaylen. Not that this is a bad game, but I'd expect a big game too from Jaylen after this. I thought it was going to be a big game. He had what, the first 5 points of the game. But one thing that was abundantly clear throughout this game, we talked about the issues Miami is going to have defensively in this series. It goes both ways because I just don't know how they're going to find consistent offense throughout this series. You look at this team without Jimmy Butler this year. With Butler on the floor, they had a 117.7 offensive rating, which is good. It would rank sixth in the NBA. If you look at the numbers with Butler off the floor, drops to a 110.8, that would rank 25th. So they're bottom of the league offense without Jimmy Butler. And even if you take it and say, okay, Brian, well, what if they just have Bam and Hero, who should be their two best offensive players, without Butler? Okay, so if you take Butler out and you have just Bam and Hero on the court, it's a large sample size. It's 541 minutes, a 112.8 offensive rating, 23rd. So even when their best two offensive players outside of Jimmy Butler are on the court together, they don't have good offense. And you can see, they really don't. And Bam's not a guy that can just like take over games. He's their best player on that's currently playing because Butler's out. But you can't just say, hey, Bam, here's the ball, go take it over. He's just not capable of doing something like that. So then you look at, well, how are they going to make this up without Jimmy Butler? Obviously, the numbers on the season aren't good. But hey, free throw attempts per 100 possessions, they're elite with Butler. 24.8 they take, which is second because Butler always gets to the free throw line. With Butler off the floor, 20.9. That would rank 21st. So they don't get to the free throw line without Jimmy Butler because they don't have a lot of drivers. And Jimmy's really good at the BS foul drawing. He does the double pump fake. He gets you up in the air in the first one. Then the second one is when he's able to get the foul on you. Like, this is something that Jimmy Butler's done throughout his career. So if you look at the numbers in this game, I gave you what they do on the season without Butler. In this game, the Heat had a 105.6 offensive rating. That's horrendous. For example, the Memphis Grizzlies, who I think they set the record for the most players that they played in a single season, the Memphis Grizzlies were last in the NBA with a 106.8 rating. The Heat had a 105.6. So the Celtics made them look worse than the worst offense in the NBA this past season. That's how bad they were. Without Jimmy, did they get to the free throw line? No, they took 6 free throws. Charlotte takes the fewest at 18.4. They took 6 free throws. So they couldn't get to the free throw line. And the Celtics, by the way, they don't foul. This is one of the real strengths of the Celtics defense. They give up the fewest free throw attempts per game at 17.3. So it's the strength of the Celtics to begin with, but especially without Jimmy, they're not going to get to the free throw line. So they have, and by the way, they have no drivers. I wouldn't want Tyler Hero trying to drive. You see this guy dribbling? He can't dribble. He really cannot dribble. And then you think about, okay, Bam's not a foul drawing type of guy. They don't have any. Like, you have nobody that can beat you one-on-one. Like, they desperately need Rozier, who can do a little bit of that, but the Celtics have so many guys that they can match up with their ball handlers, if you will. The other thing about Miami, so they've never been a team that takes a lot of threes, but with Jimmy on the court, at least they get to the free throw line, right? Like, they win in other areas, but without Jimmy, you would think, okay, they got to get up more threes. They make just 12.5 per game, which is 19th. They made 12 in this game, so they're below their average. And if you look at the numbers in the game, the Celtics hit, what, 22, so 66 to the 12 that the Heat hit, so 36. So the Celtics outscored them by 30 points at the three-point line. So they can't make up for this in other areas. They're not going to outshoot the Celtics from three. They don't get to the free throw line. It's just really difficult to say, where is Spoelstra going to come up with something that can beat the Celtics? It's really, it's a player's thing. It's a personnel thing. And I said, I think I said it on the pod, if I didn't, I said, if it's Chicago, I'm going to pick the Celtics to sweep. And if it's Miami, I'm going to pick the Celtics to win in five. I'm tempted to go to a sweep territory now. And I know this whole thing about, hey, Brian, you don't want to overreact to one game, but this is what I expected. So when sort of what you thought actually occurs in front of your eyes, it sort of confirms your belief in the series. I don't know. You tell me. I just don't know how the Heat are scoring. I don't know how the Heat are defending the Celtics. I just feel like this team is in major trouble. And again, the bracket breaking this way for the Celtics is so awesome, because that 76ers game was awesome on Saturday. Hopefully that's a long battle. We'll see Embiid. We'll see a status throughout this series, because already getting banged up in game one, but we'll see that. It feels like teams are going to throw haymakers at each other. I hope that Orlando can find a way to get back in that series against Cleveland, because you'd like them to go back and forth. But this is what we thought. This is going to be a very easy path for the Celtics, especially considering the injury to Jimmy Butler, and it looked every bit of that. Now, keep this up. Keep this energy up. And I think, if anything else, the Celtics should have learned from the previous seasons, hey, just make sure you take care of your business, right? Like, if you have a chance to make a series, a short one, do it. Don't do what you did against Atlanta last year, where you felt like, okay, this is going to be a blowout, and then Atlanta gets a game, and then you have to go back to Atlanta to win in game six. Just take care of business. Now, and quite frankly, you look at the two teams. They don't have as much talent as Atlanta did last year, considering they don't have Jimmy Butler right now. So I don't see the Heat being able to put up a fight. I know they're going to battle in all this, and I don't know how many times that Doris Burke had to praise the Heat for, this is what the Heat do. They're playing her. It's like, they're losing by 20. I get the message that she's trying to convey, that the Heat are a tough team. I get it, but they're down 20. Like, okay, they're playing hard. Congratulations. Still down 20. But anyway, one thing I didn't like, and I guess we're in playoff time, so I can get to some of these things with the broadcast. I like Mike Breen. Love JJ. I like Doris Burke. Obviously not the biggest fan of Perk on the pregame show, but that goes, I don't want to get into the pregame show. But one of the things I don't like about the actual broadcast, we don't need to know how far every three is. If you want to trot it out there when Porzingis is taking a 27-footer, fine. You want to put that little graphic that says 27 feet. I don't need it every time there's a three. That, to me, is just annoying more than anything else. Stop putting that thing down. But all right, so looking ahead to game two on Wednesday night, FanDuel is going to have a featured bet that'll be live 24 hours before that game. So you want to make sure you're looking out for that. And one of the things that I'd be looking at, I'll give you a few. First of all, Jalen, as we mentioned, the 17. So I like him to go over his points in this next game coming up on Wednesday. And I would look at over on both Porzingis and Derek White threes, because if you look at how Miami's playing in terms of the zone and whatnot, Porzingis got up 8 in this game. Derek White got up 8 as well. So I would look at over Porzingis threes, over Derek White threes, and over Jaylen Brown total points. All right, a lot more to get into. We'll get to the other team that won a playoff game. We'll get to the Bees next. The road to the NBA Finals starts now, and new customers on FanDuel can go on their own playoff run with $150. Just place any $5 bet, and you'll get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose, to use during the NBA playoffs. And FanDuel is now live in our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Just go to FanDuel.com/pike to get started. FanDuel, official sports betting partner of the NBA. Must be 21+, 18+ in D.C., and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit rg-help.com. First online real money wager only. $10 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Welcome back into Off the Pike. So the other big victory this weekend, of course, the Bruins, they take out the Leafs in game one of their series. It was real interesting on Saturday. And this goes back to earlier in the week, too, that basically Jim Montgomery was saying he knows the plan. The goalies know the plan, but he's not going to reveal the plan until he needs to reveal the plan, which is basically before game one. And this went until Saturday morning. Saturday morning, we didn't know who was starting for the Bruins in the net. And we had the debate with Razor on the pod to preview last Thursday when we were previewing the series. I thought it was going to be Ullmark in the net based on the fact that he had been the superior goaltender post All-Star break. But then I thought, okay, if there's an argument for Swayman, minutes, he's played really well against the Leafs this season. So I give Montgomery credit here, of course, going with Swayman, because to me, this wasn't the obvious decision. I feel like if Swayman played poorly in that game and say things were reversed and the Bruins were the team that lost game one and Swayman was not good in that game, most people would have pointed at the coach and say, well, wait, hold on. Why are you starting Swayman? Ullmark was the better goaltender down the stretch. So I don't think that was the obvious choice. I thought that was the more difficult choice to put Swayman in the net. Here was what Montgomery said about starting Swayman. We felt that Swayman hadn't had the opportunity to start a series. So that was interesting to me, where even if you go back to a couple of years ago, that Carolina series, remember, it was Ullmark that started the first two games of that series before they turned it over to Swayman because Ullmark was not good in that series. So what happens here is you don't have Swayman coming in to this Leafs series, say, hypothetically down the road, where like last year, you had to save the team in game seven, right? Because Ullmark was not performing well later on in that series. So this is different, where it's sort of he gets to set the tone and he gets to build his confidence after a game one win. And I bet if you asked both goaltenders, by the way, they would have thought that it was going to be Ullmark. But Ullmark, really, he didn't need the confidence of getting off to a quick start in a series because he was good in that game one last year where he gave up just one goal on 31 shots. He had 43 saves in game four. So before things came undone for Ullmark, he was playing well in that series. And so now Swayman gets sort of the mojo going early where there's less pressure now on Swayman, where it's, all right, you got game one, you got the win under your belt, and it's not, you're coming into this, because ordinarily when we see the switch, it's because one goaltender is not playing well. He doesn't have to deal with this time. This is just, hey, you got off to a great start in the series, and you build up your confidence that way, and he finishes with 35 saves. Really, the only mistake he made is he tried to challenge Matthews when, remember, McAvoy fell, and Matthews was coming in, and he tried to go out and basically poke check it away from Matthews, and Matthews essentially missed a wide open net there, hit the post, and then after that, outside of that one miscue by Swayman, he was dominant in this game. And the Bees, by the way, after that play, they basically score right after that. DeBrus set up Carlo to make it 2-0. So this now becomes a question for Montgomery. Where is he going in game two? When he was asked about who's starting in game two, he said he had not thought that far ahead, but it's hard to go away from Swayman. So huge, right, where, and I would expect, I would be shocked if it's not Swayman in game two, but it's huge that now, right away, your goaltender is dialed into the series, and you know that you have a really good option behind him at Ullmark, who played better post-All-Star break. So you have that, too, to go back to if you do need to make a change. But I thought that Swayman was outstanding in the game, and I give Montgomery a ton of credit. I got to be fair to Montgomery. Last year, I criticized him for a lot of moves that he made throughout the postseason. We talked about some of those with Razor the other day, whether it was, hey, why is Marchand and Bergeron not on the same line when Bergeron came back? He got back to that quickly, but remember the whole decision. Why is Clifton in? Why is Grizzlick out? Why did it take so long to go to Swayman? And especially considering Ullmark was banged up, I got to give him credit. This decision really paid off for the Bees. Okay, the next thing that stuck out to me, and I'm sure this stuck out to a lot of you, just the Leafs played so dumb in that game. And I know this is not a shocker to anyone, but they played completely out of control, completely reckless. And I know that it's sort of a difficult thing when you go into a game and you realize Nylander's not going to play. And the Leafs had sort of hinted at that. The players had hinted it throughout the week that they didn't think Nylander was going to play. They never actually made it official until before the game. But this is a guy that was second on the team in points with 98. And he was second on the team in goals with 40. So basically losing your second most dynamic offensive player, that's a kick in the nuts before the playoffs start, especially considering this is a guy that played in all 82 games and he got hurt in that Washington game. That sort of sucks, right? And the Leafs, they like sack guys that were banged up in game 82, Nylander wasn't, and he ended up getting injured in that particular game. And you know how it is in the NHL. They don't really reveal too much in terms of what the actual injury was. But that's not an excuse for the way that they played. And maybe, hey, if they have Nylander, could it have been a different game? Certainly. But if they were going to play this dumb, they were not going to have any chance with Nylander either, because they were out of control in that game. It was such a bizarre start to the game where Domi is trying to get into it with Marchand on the opening faceoff. What do you think is going to happen? You think Marchand is going to engage you at that point? This guy's been in the league forever now, a decade and a half. He's played in a million playoff games. You think he wants to take himself off the ice at that point in the game? Not even that point in the game, before the game even starts? So right then and there, I felt to myself, I don't know if it was sort of a carryover effect of, hey, not having Nylander, or is like one of these things where the Bruins, by their reputation and by what we see, they're the tougher, more physical team, that they felt like, hey, we got to prove ourselves early on in this game. That was just so stupid. No idea what they were doing. And when they did that, you kind of thought, the series hasn't started. They haven't even dropped the puck for the opening faceoff, and they're already in the Leafs' head. Like, this is unbelievable. I know it's different personnel throughout the years, but this group has been together for a while in Toronto, but they just could not get out of their own way. And you start to think about other reckless plays they had in this game. Matthews, their best player, one of what, the five best players in the NHL, a guy that has won a Hart Trophy, a guy that had 69 goals, gets a high stick on McAvoy. So the Bees get a power play. They make it 3-0 right after that. Okay, literally 30 seconds after that, basically they score another goal, the Bruins do, because Domi, not shockingly, after we saw what happened, what transpired there on that opening faceoff, he slashed Marchand off a faceoff. Just idiotic. You're trying to get back in the game and you take that penalty, and then Marchand sets up DeBrus. They make it a 4-0 game. So it's over. Sheldon Keefe, of course, the Maple Leafs coach after the game, The careless penalties, he was asked about. Domi's is the one I would call an undisciplined penalty. You think? Yeah, kind of undisciplined. He says, I understand what he's trying to do. I don't, but anyway, he said, but he crossed the line there. You can't do that. The high sticks, that's just careless stuff. One team was ready to play. One team was not. The Bruins came ready. Toronto just looked like an inexperienced team, which they're not. And quite frankly, they look like the Leafs have looked in previous years. They were not ready for the season, or rather the season, the playoffs to get underway. And whether or not you want to attribute some of that to Nylander not being there, I don't think that's what it is. I just think this team is not as dialed in right now as the Bruins are. So we referenced with Razor that the Bees need to get their power play going. The Bees in this post-All-Star break, they were 28th in power play goals. The Leafs on the season, 23rd in penalty kill, so 23rd on the PK. Toronto just kept giving them chances on that. Like, this is what the Bruins needed. Hey, give us more opportunities on our power play. We're trying to work through some things here, right? And if you think about it, what did they do? They scored back-to-back power play goals because Toronto gave them those opportunities, especially the second one. After you're trying to kill off a penalty, you give them another penalty again. This is great for the Bruins that they got an opportunity or opportunities frequently in this game to work on their power play, because Toronto played so stupidly in this game. Okay, so that was big to me. And outside of Swayman, I would say, and you could maybe even argue more important, is holy shit, DeBrusk was awesome in this game. He finishes with 2 goals, has the assist. And remember, he's a free agent. And he didn't have the season that he wanted. Remember, just a 40-point season after 50 last year. And he put up, if you look at the numbers on that, he played what? 16 less games last season compared to this year, because remember, he got hurt in the Winter Classic and he scored actually 2 goals in that Winter Classic game that he got hurt. But you get the point, is he put up the 50 points in 16 less games than the 40 points he did this year. So here's what DeBrusk had to say after the game. Obviously, I didn't like my season. It was pretty disappointing for myself. But at this point in time, we get a chance to go for the ultimate goal, and that's all that really matters. So this is something that you desperately wanted to see from this team. Where was the secondary scoring going to come from, obviously? Because we know that Pasta is going to be the guy. Everybody's trying to stop Pasta. Who else is going to step up for this team? It was DeBrusk. And he had the beautiful feed to Carlo that I briefly referenced earlier for the second goal. And then on the power play, second one beats Samsonov, which you love to see that, where he just shot it. Like, it seems simplistic. The Bruins, a lot of times in these power plays, and not recently because it seems like they found something here, but they take too long. And you see so many of these teams that are successful on the power play, they just shoot more, like Florida. They always just want to get the puck on the net. And we saw that with DeBrusk there. Great shot from him. they get the goal there, and then he gets the next power play goal where Marchand sets him up in front of the net. So really nice play there from DeBrusk all in all in this game and throughout the season. If he's going to be the guy that we saw last season in the playoffs, where he was really good last season, he can give this team a major boost with his speed, with his goal scoring ability. It would be massive if we see this guy have this type of run in the playoffs. Not that I'm saying I'm expecting 3 points every night from the guy, but can he be a consistent player for this team? And he was awesome in that game one. So next, I want to get to Pat Maroon because he plays just two games all season for the Bruins, of course, because when he was traded here, he was dealing with the injury. But we know why he's here, right? He's here for the playoffs, won 3 straight Stanley Cups. And the reason he's here, 6 hits in that game, including just tossing a dude over into the Bruins bench. It was incredible just to get everybody fired up. Lauko's taking shots, like just like setting the tone immediately. That's what you love to see. It was Liljegren, I think it was, and he flipped it. Just unbelievable stuff. And by the way, this is something the Bruins did really well in this game. DeBrusk, I said, was awesome. 5 hits. Frederick, 5 hits. Lauko, 5 hits. They brought the physicality to the Leafs, and in particular, Maroon. He's just tossing bodies. Even the first goal of this game, you look at it, he took on basically 2 hits, found Boqvist, and that set up the 2-on-1 where Beecher gets the goal to make it 2, to give the Bruins the opening lead to make it 1-0 on that 2-on-1. And by the way, Beecher was awesome in this game. It's not a guy that we expected a lot from in the playoffs, and he was awesome in this game. And then the other thing I would mention, too, is something that we got into a bit with Razor. We saw what the Bruins wanted to do with the Matthews line, where, remember, towards the end of the season, it was Lindholm and McAvoy paired up together. In this game, they went back to Lindholm and Carlo because Carlo has had so much success against Austin Matthews' line this year. They put those guys back together. So on 5-on-5 in this game on Saturday night, the Bees outscore the Leafs 2-0 on 5-on-5 with Carlo and with Lindholm on the ice. And most of the time that those guys spent out on the ice, it was against the Matthews line. So that's definitely, that was encouraging, where he looked at the regular season, did Montgomery, and say, hey, this is successful against the Matthews line. Let's not overthink this, because at times last year I thought he overthought things. Let's just go to this. So that was a really encouraging sign from the Bruins. If they win game 2, and I know you could say, Brian, don't jinx it, or anything along those lines, I really think they're going to win this series relatively easily if they win this game 2. Now, remember last year, Florida wins game 2, the Bruins win 2, but then Florida comes back, they win a game. But if they can just get out to a 2-0 lead, I really truly believe that this is going to be a situation where the Bruins win this one relatively easily because they have the advantage with the goaltender situation. Now, I should say this, Nylander was skating as we're recording it Sunday, so he's skating this morning. So we'll see. Nylander obviously can make a major difference, but I really just, and look, maybe Toronto comes into this game because I picked him in 7, you heard me, but, and maybe I'm overreacting to one game, but what I saw was one team was incredibly disciplined and one team was just, they weren't there mentally. And this is something that we've seen throughout the Leafs' history in the postseason. They tend to choke throughout these series. So maybe I'll regret saying, I think if the Bruins win game 2, they'll win relatively easily. My original pick is 7. We'll see if I'm wrong or right about that. But I was very encouraged what we saw from the Bruins. Not just because the Leafs played so poorly, but think about all the developments we got in that game. Where, and we talked about a bunch of them, Swayman was awesome. And you know you have a good option after that. DeBrusk was incredible in this game. And you didn't even need Pasta to be outstanding in this game. Carlo and Lindholm were dominant. Maroon, like, that's why you traded for him. He brings the necessary physicality to this series. The third line, I would say, was very physical when you look at the numbers in terms of the hits. So all in all, this is a very impressive showing for the Bruins in game 1. Obviously, a good performance from the Celtics in game 1 as well. All right, coming up next, we'll bring in producer extraordinaire Jamie McClellan.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The 7-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Welcome back into Off the Pike. Joining us now, he is wearing his Celtics Paul Pierce jersey, alternate jersey right now. It is producer extraordinaire, Jamie McClellan. Jamie, what's going on, man? Nice little weekend here in Boston.
Great weekend, Brian. Like you said, very optimistic about both these series. And thanks for the shout out of the jersey. This is a Reebok jersey, Brian. This isn't even the former sponsor of the NBA. This was two sponsors ago.
That's old. Oh, yeah. It was Adidas in between, which made the worst jerseys of all time. Remember those short sleeve jerseys?
Oh, the sleeve ones. They were so tight, too. It's like, come on. We don't all have NBA bodies, guys. We can't wear these.
They're also just dumb.
They look bad, too.
Just like changed how jersey, like short sleeve jerseys are supposed to be sleeveless. What are we doing?
That was a swing and a miss.
So what'd you make of game one, both game ones?
I'm with you, Brian. I mean, just because you're talking about the Bruins last, like how, you know, hockey could be a little crazy in the playoffs in terms of not getting too confident after one game, and especially after last year. But as you mentioned, I mean, I don't think Toronto's Florida in the sense, like, I'm not worried about, they're just not the same team. Like, they're not nearly as scrappy. They're dumb. So,
by the way, that's a great point. Let me follow up on something you said there, because not to interrupt you, although I just interrupted you. So after I interrupt you, that's a great point on Florida. Because, like, the shit that Domi was doing to start the game to Marshawn, if somebody on Florida did that, it'd be like, okay, this is who they are. Like, this is who Kachuk is. This is how this team plays, right? They're the team that wants to be the bigger, tougher team. They want to, like, Kachuk, he's an agitator, just like Marshawn is. Like, they want to get under your skin. That's not who Toronto is. They're not that type of team. So they almost, like, got out of character for this game.
It's not that type of team. I'm not sure the type of team that they actually are is that effective, at least in the postseason, or hasn't been the past couple of years. So it's hard to get too worked up about them. And then in terms of the goalie stuff, too, I feel like trying to have an interesting take about this. But at the same time, I feel like you're kind of good either way, right? They're both studs. Like, I honestly don't care that much about who plays game two, right? Like, do you feel strongly one way or the other?
I just think it's going to be Swayman. Stick with him. I think that they should stick with Swayman for game two. And as Montgomery said, it's going to be very difficult not to. But if they go up, this is where it gets difficult for Montgomery. What if you go up 2-0 and then you go to Toronto and Swayman's playing awesome? What do you take him out for game three? Because that's what they've been doing all season long. So I think that's where it just becomes a difficult sort of thing to navigate throughout the postseason. But I would say this, like, and I know it's going to be difficult for Montgomery to make this change if they're up, say, 2-0. But at some point, you want to get Ullmark in there because, and I know it's not conventional. This is not what they've been doing all season long. But they also, down the stretch of the season, didn't say, like, because obviously Swayman got game one, they didn't say, hey, Swayman, go start the final four games. Right? Like, they didn't get one guy set up for it. Like, they played Ullmark a lot more than Swayman last year, where it's like you knew it was going to be Ullmark. They didn't do that, where they're like, hey, Swayman, just play a bunch down the stretch. So I do think they want to use both goaltenders. But is Montgomery going to be able to do it where it's like, that's tough to do, man. If you get up 2-0 and then Toronto, they win game three at home and Ullmark doesn't play well, do you let Toronto back in the series? And then you're second guessing yourself where you're here and everybody criticizing you. So I do think it's a very difficult decision for Montgomery to make, right? Like, it's not easy.
No, I mean, no matter who is in goal, the first game they lose this postseason, that's going to be the number one thing they talk about, I feel like, right? Why didn't they go the other goalie? But
the goalie thing is the biggest talking point with the Bruins for the past 2 years.
Yeah.
Like, that's not even hyperbolic. That's what everybody talks about with the Bruins.
But it was deserved last year, right? Like, they stuck with Ullmark too long and it cost them.
Especially, too, when we found out after that, he was actually banged up, too. Right? Like, Okay. Probably should have made a switch.
Yeah. And then in terms of the other series, Brian, I think lastly you just said, like, it doesn't seem that close. It just feels to me like this is the one seed playing the eight seed. Like, they just showed the starting lineups at the beginning of the game. I literally exclaimed, like, holy shit. Like, we are so much more talented than them. And you mentioned they played eight guys tonight, the Celtics. Every single player on the Celtics played very well, I thought. And, you know, it's like it was a complete win. I thought that was one of their best games of the year. Is that too far?
No, they were dominant start to finish. And it felt to me, you know what it felt like? Like the way they've been playing all regular season.
Yeah.
They just beat the crap out of teams, right? And that's what they did in this game today. And it's like the fourth, I did think it was weird, the whole fourth quarter where it's Jason Tatum still out there with like a minute left. Like,
hurts his hip. Did you see, by the way, did you see what Mazzulla said about that foul after the game?
Yeah, he liked it.
He said, I was kind of excited about the whole situation. I enjoyed watching it. Like, what happens the next time he passes Jason Tatum? Like, what do they talk about? Do you think he's just trolling the media? Like, what does that mean?
No, I think that Mazzulla, and I say this in a complimentary way, he is legitimately out of his mind.
Yeah.
Legitimately. In a great way. He is just crazy. He's wired different. I mean, this guy... He is incredibly competitive. And I know you say, oh, Brian, he's an NBA coach. You don't think... Yes, but he is like in the top 1% of competitors. Like, this guy is ruthless. This guy, he literally, and I think we talked about this with Pina last week, he legitimately was trying to contest other guys' shots incredible on the team. He did this all year until he was reprimanded. Like, this is the type of stuff that this guy does. I mean, that is psychotic. He's an NBA coach that also does jujitsu.
What was the shirt again, that. Brian? My favorite shirt. I got to get one of these shirts.
Yeah, no, it was Jesus, Coffee, Jiu-Jitsu. I don't remember the exact order of that, but those are the three.
You know, Brian, they have the t-shirt stands outside the Garden, outside Fenway or something. They got to get those shirts.
I think they outside. Do. I actually think
I would
they
buy
do.
Them. Yeah?
Unless somebody got them. So I saw somebody. I think I've seen people wearing them.
I might need to get one.
Unless I just imagine that, but I'm pretty sure. They may not sell them outside of the Garden, but I'm pretty sure you can buy that shirt somewhere.
All right, I'm looking on.
And if eBay not, man, start printing those shirts and making them yourself, and you'll have
watch
a winner
out, Brian.
Experience.
I might have a new gig then. Could be my new job. But if you're super competitive, though, why do you enjoy watching that? I was kind of pissed in the moment. He just runs, the game's over, and he just beelines over to Tatum and knocks him down. That's bullshit.
Yeah, I was confused why they. I have the.
Watching Clippers?
I have the Clippers Mavericks on in the background. But
Clippers are missing. What's going on?
I don't know, man. That's a weird situation without Kawhi. What a weird career that guy's had. Not to go on a complete tangent, but
right,
the guy wins a finals MVP in San Antonio when he wasn't like the guy yet, turns into one of the best players in the NBA, goes and wins the championship, wants out of there because they can't get along. The two sides can't agree on what the injury is. Gets traded to Toronto, wins a championship there, goes to the Clippers, basically has one healthy postseason. He chokes against the Denver Nuggets down 3-1, like the team chokes. And since then, he never plays in the playoffs anymore. He played two games against Phoenix last year. He's awesome. He gets hurt. So he's had one of the most bizarre careers in NBA history to me. But anyway, I don't want to go into a Kawhi digression there, although I already went into a Kawhi digression there. But I think that, I don't know. To answer your question about why Joe likes it, I think he just likes the battle of it, right? Like the fact that they're going at it. I like that Jalen, like I mentioned
earlier.
I like
that Jalen got involved.
Yeah, Jalen's like, okay, none of this. None of this, man. But the best part was Tatum. Tatum just bounces right back up. He's like, let's go.
Well, it was a perfect compliment for each other. I love that he was the one who got up and said, let's go shoot these free throws and put this game away. But then it was like the perfect 1-2 punch, you know, Batman and Robin kind of thing. So I like that a lot.
Yeah, and I do like that he shortened the bench in this game where it was just Hauser, Al, and Pritchard.
And they crushed.
And one of the things I'd say about last year's postseason run is they didn't really know their rotation. Right? Because remember, if you go back to the Atlanta series, Grant didn't play in the first two games. And then Grant did play. Remember, Hauser was playing. He wasn't hitting shots, so they went to Grant. And part of this is, look, this in a way is a front office win, this game too, right? Well, not a front office win, but it's like, okay, we know what we're doing here, right? This is why Porzingis is here. And now we have Drew to guard the other team's best player if we want to do that or use him in different ways. But Porzingis unlocks our offense, right? So from a front office perspective, they've helped Joe. Like, Joe's decisions are easier this year than they were last year. But even going back to the Philadelphia series, I thought it took them, and we talked about it on the pod, this was the series to go to the double big. Because Philadelphia, if you remember back to that series, they were starting P.J. Tucker.
Right.
And P.J. Tucker is the guy that you can cheat off. Even if he hits a couple of threes, you're not going to overreact because you're going to live with P.J. So that's when Rob could play. Because Rob could be that free safety play off him and muck things up, right? So I thought it took him too long to get to that. And in this game today, he immediately knew I'm only playing these eight guys. So I liked it. Like, and this is part of the process where all season long, because they had such a big lead, they were experimenting with different lineups. And he felt like, hey, these are the three guys that make sense in these series. These are the three guys we need. We're not worried about a big because Bam's not a traditional big. So it's not like we need... And if you did, you'd have Al anyway. They actually felt in this, which I thought was interesting, they actually started Porzingis on Bam. I didn't expect that. I didn't expect
they
would do
that. I didn't think that worked out too well,
But I think part of the, I actually agree with the decision because I don't think, even though Bam got his points, I think they're more worried about Bam being sort of the hub of their offense where mm-hmm. they're running every, because he's their best playmaker. Hero's not a good passer, and he's not a good dribbler, right? I mean, he's which is kind of important in the NBA. You should probably be better at dribbling if you're going to be a guard that, well, he's made a lot of money, so I shouldn't criticize him that much. But you get my point. It's like, I think it's one of these things where they'll live with Bam scoring. They don't want to live with Bam setting the tone for everything they do. So mm-hmm. I thought it was a great game one. I thought Missoula, the only critique is, like, I think that, well, maybe not based on the way that they came back, but I just like to keep the minutes down again. Yeah. And the one thing I will say too is I think that, and I know we're in the playoffs now, I think sometimes you got to be careful with certain guys' minutes. Not that you're saving guys for anything else, but if you look at the numbers, like Tatum, 41 minutes for Tatum, totally fine with that. Jaylen, 34, totally fine with that. Derek White, 33, totally fine with that.
Yeah.
But I do think that Drew playing 33, Pritchard playing 24, I don't think you have to have a 9-minute difference on that. Yeah, because Pritchard was really good. And I know Drew's job was to cover Tyler Hero.
Right.
But you have a bunch of guys you can throw on Tyler Hero. And Pritchard can be thrown on Tyler Hero. So I just think that, like, Drew, like, you got to take care of, like, the older guys on the team, right?
Where Pritchard just looking so confident out there. Do you see that three-pointer hit in the first half? It's like a little bit, or half-court three?
Wait, well, yeah, where the TD is, where it says
TD.
Yeah,
man. Like, he's playing so confidently. It's great to have him doing that. Really
and, you know, exciting. One of the things, now that you mention that, now that I think about this, is one of the things that's interesting to me is, remember down the stretch of the season, Pritchard was one of the guys that was always playing, and he was getting extent where he set his career high in points. So not that he was not a confident player to begin with. He's a very confident player. But I do wonder if, hey, getting his time to sort of run everything, that's actually beneficial for this team, where mm-hmm. he plays with incredible confidence. And I totally agree. J.J. Redick said this on the broadcast. I said this to Pina when we were doing the pre-playoff pod, if you will. He changes the game when he comes in. He plays at that pace. Yeah, if he's in the corner, he's going to crash. He's going to push the ball up the floor. Like, he's just a really good player.
I mean,
at this point, that's exactly what Redick said too on the broadcast. He's like, he is. He's a really good player. Hauser's a specialist who they're like, all right, they're in a zone. Boom. Go hit a couple of threes. He had 4 and 8 minutes. It's a really good rotation they have going right now. Now, certainly as the playoffs go on, they're going to have to use some of the other guys in certain matchups. But for this matchup, just don't mess around. End these guys, please. End them, please.
Yes, please. I don't want to see the Heat. I don't want to see them come back, so I agree. Speaking of which, though, Brian, in terms of ending series, I saw the Clippers are up right now, and if they win, that'll be every single home team will have won the game so far this weekend. What do you think is going to be the most competitive series, though? Like the Philly-Knicks one, or what?
That one looks pretty competitive. The only thing I'd say, at one point I thought Philly was going to win that game, but the only thing I'd say is I would worry, does Embiid make it to the finish line?
His knee.
This guy cannot go a full game without being banged up.
Like, I mean, he's literally getting banged up, though. I can't tell if it's like he's injury prone. It seems like some guy's landing on him every other game. I mean, maybe that's just part of the deal when you're 7-3 and things get scrappy in the postseason.
True. But yeah, it just feels like every game this guy comes into, something happens to him. And I know that he came back from a severe injury, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like, and he's big. I mean, 270 pounds. Yeah. You do wonder if, like, going into the future, they would want him to slim down a little bit, because it's a lot of weight on those legs. I mean, 270 pounds, but I would say that one should be competitive. I don't think that Orlando, and I hope that Orlando and Cleveland is competitive, like I said earlier. I don't think it's going to be. I just don't think that Orlando has enough scoring. They don't have enough scoring to keep up with that. Not that Cleveland is the 16-17 Warriors, but I just don't think they have enough scoring. Mitchell did look really good. That was one. My one big takeaway from that game on Saturday is Mitchell looks, because he was not great coming back from the injury. Maybe some of the time off, because they went, what, Sunday to Saturday. And I don't even think he played in the second half of that Charlotte game. But anyway, even though the Clippers are winning this game, reporting they're up big, but they could definitely make him competitive. And I think the Suns will make that series competitive against Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
That was an interesting series, interesting game one, because they basically said, Edwards is awesome, man. Just talking all the shit, too. I mean, getting into it with KD, Beal. What I found interesting about that is they put Towns on Durant, and basically it was like, Durant's going to have to score 50 for you guys to win, and he still scored like 34. But they put McDaniels on Booker, and Booker had some real issues. McDaniels locked him up. And I do wonder if their plan was, hey, let's put our best two defenders on Beal and Booker. Let KD do his thing, but we can't let all these guys get going. So it's interesting to see what they do going forward in that matchup. I don't think the Lakers-Nuggets series is going to be competitive, even though the Lakers had that great fight in game one. LeBron's hitting that shot from past the hash mark, almost near half court, and the Nuggets still win. And I don't even think the Nuggets played their best basketball. It's just like Jokic and company closed it out. I don't think that series is going to be competitive. So I do think, and look, this is before this game starts. I may look like an idiot tomorrow morning. I do think that by the time most people hear this, I do think the Pelicans can make a series out of this OKC thing.
You think?
Because they're big. And I know they don't have Zion, but they're big.
Zion.
That's the type of stuff that OKC struggles with. They're one of the worst rebounding teams in the NBA. Like, you can... And, like, Valanciunas, and look, Chet has his advantages in that series where he can take them out and hit threes. But Valanciunas has got to weigh, what, like 50, I would guess 50, 60 more pounds than Chet Holmgren does. Like, that's a big dude, so we'll see. Hopefully we get a couple of good series, and hopefully this one sucks. Hopefully this series sucks for entertainment purposes, just to blow up.
Yeah. One programming note, though, Brian. I saw tonight the Pelicans game is on at 9:30 Eastern. Why is the Sunday night game later than the Saturday night game? Last night's game, the Nuggets-Lakers, was 8:30, and two teams playing in later time zones. They're Mountain Time, Pacific Time. I think New Orleans is in Central or Eastern. I think it's in Central Time. But just, I want a little more late-night basketball on a Saturday night. They ended too quickly last night, I thought.
Yeah. Not for me here on the East Coast, but that is kind of weird that the Sunday night final game starts later than the Saturday night final game.
With teams that are further east than the games on Saturday. Just a little nitpick.
Denver's Mountain Time, correct?
Yeah, and then the Lakers.
Yeah, that is weird. I don't know. All right, Jamie. Good stuff, man.
Thank you, Brian.
All right, as always, make sure to get your voicemails in at 617-396-7172. Email your thoughts and questions to offthepike@gmail.com. Thanks to Jamie McClellan and Steve Strudy for producing this podcast, and we'll chat in a couple of days. Must be 21 plus, 18 plus in D.C. and present in select states. FanDuel is offering online sports wagering in Kansas under an agreement with Kansas Star Casino, LLC. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit FanDuel.com/RG in Colorado, D.C., Iowa, Michigan, New Jersey, North Carolina, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Illinois, Kentucky, Tennessee, Virginia, and Vermont. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP or text NEXTSTEP to 53342 in Arizona. 1-888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org/chat in Connecticut. 1-800-9-WITH-IT in Indiana. 1-800-522-4700 or visit ksgamblinghelp.com in Kansas. 1-877-770-STOP in Louisiana. Visit mdgamblinghelp.org in Maryland. Visit 1800gambler.net in West Virginia or call 1-800-522-4700 in Wyoming. Hope is here. Visit gamblinghelplinema.org or call 800-327-5050 for 24/7 support in Massachusetts. Call 1-877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY in New York.